looking this morning at the way of the king. The way of the king. Mark chapter 10. We're in the middle of a journey, and we're going to continue that journey with Jesus as he moves toward Jerusalem. Mark chapter 10, we're beginning in verse 32 this morning. We'll read down through the end of the chapter. Verse 32, "And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem. And Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, 'Behold, or see, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes. They will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him, and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise.' James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, 'Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you.' He said to them, 'What do you want me to do for you?' They said to him, 'Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory.' Jesus said to them, 'You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?' And they said to him, 'We are able.' Jesus said to them, 'The cup that I drink, you will drink, and the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared.' When the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, 'You know that those who are considered rulers, or lords of the Gentiles, lord it over them. Their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many.' And they came up to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a great crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside. And when he had heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, 'Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me.' Many rebuked him, telling him to be silent. But he cried out all the more, 'Son of David, have mercy on me.' And Jesus stopped and said, 'Call him.' And they called the blind man, saying to him, 'Take heart, get up, he's calling you.' And throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, 'What do you want me to do for you?' And the blind man said to him, 'Rabbi, let me recover my sight.' And Jesus said to him, 'Go your way. Your faith has made you well.' And immediately he recovered his sight and followed him on the way." Very few of us have not heard the story of Helen Keller. Ann Sullivan, her teacher, sometimes called the miracle worker, the play, the video that was put together of her life. At the age of 19 months, Helen contracted scarlet fever. As a result, she lost both her vision and her hearing. Without the loss of hearing, she also lost her ability to communicate. She became essentially mute, with no way of communicating except through self-developed signs that she would try to communicate with somebody, simply a push to go, a tug to come, simple ways of trying to communicate with the outside world. A woman who was locked in to her own life. It was at the age of 6 that Ann Sullivan then came into little Helen's life. She herself had wrestled with eyesight problems, but she was a teacher. She learned, and she stepped into Helen's little world and became the eyes and the ears that this infant had lost. And it was through Ann then that Helen eventually gained her own voice. She later became the first deaf-blind person to receive a Bachelor of Arts degree. She went on to become an inspirational speaker. But the amazing thing about Helen is her spirit. She never felt sorry for herself. Well, she did early on, but she overcame that as she continued to press into the outside world and understand more of life about her. She retained that childlike wonder and simplicity, probably better than most of us at things she couldn't see and yet wanted to understand. Later in life, she reflected upon her own condition, and she mused. She said this: "It's better to be blind and see with your heart than to have two good eyes and to see nothing." Think about that for just a minute. Here's a blind person saying that. Better to have no eyes and still be able to see than to have two good eyes and really to be able to see nothing. As we come to this passage of Scripture, we're really struck with that tension. Here we have the apostles, the 12, who've been walking with Jesus for roughly 3 years. They're making their way to Jerusalem. This is now the third time that Jesus is telling them, "Guys, I'm going to die, and then I will rise again." And the first thing you have these disciples asking, so Jesus, who gets to be first in your kingdom? You're missing the point, fellas. Having eyes, you don't see. And here we have a blind man in the very next story, and they're put together on purpose. Mark telling these stories back to back in order to keep the tension in place. These men who should be able to see better than anybody else don't see. And here's a blind man sitting on the side of the road. He's not a part of the insiders. He's a part of the outsiders. He's a beggar. All he has is a coat, a cloak. And when Jesus calls to him, he even throws that away and comes to Jesus. And as the story unfolds, it says Jesus tells him, "Go your way." And it says that he went on the way to Jerusalem, following Jesus. A blind man, having no eyes to see, yet he sees better than those who had eyes, the disciples. As we come to this passage of Scripture, this passage highlights for us two separate visions of the king's way. The one is clouded with relentless self-vision or self-interest. The vision of self-interest, it clouds their eyes, it blinds them. They can't see. They don't understand what this way of the king is supposed to be. The second is clarified vision of reckless abandon. And here you have this blind man throwing away everything, giving up everything in order to follow Jesus. Let's trace these two things down, these two different visions of the way of the king this morning. As we look at verses 32 through 45, the first story that we're given with the disciples, we see that there's two phrases that are going to require exploration. The first is this: going up to Jerusalem. Look at verse 32 again. "And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem." Now, his disciples knew that Jesus was on a journey. They've been on a journey ever since they left Caesarea Philippi. If you remember your geography, Caesarea Philippi is up above the region of Galilee, up above the Sea of Galilee. It's very, very far in the north of the nation of Israel, some 25 miles above the Sea of Galilee. It was up there that Peter made his confession. "You are the Christ. You are the Messiah. You are the anointed one. You're the one upon whom the end time hopes of all peoples relies on. You're the one." Jesus says, "You're right. Now let me tell you what that means." And that was the first time that Jesus explains that for me to be the Christ, for me to be the victor, the ruler, the anointed one, for me to be that one means I must die. Peter puts his arm around Jesus and tries to take him off and says, "Listen, you can't talk like that. You've got to have a better self-esteem. We've got to raise your sight." And Jesus says, "Get behind me. You don't understand what you're talking about. You're valuing the things of earth, of man, and not the things of God." They've been on this journey. They left Caesarea Philippi, but not until they'd gone on top of a mount, three of them. Jesus brings them on the mount. He shows them what that glory is going to be, what that glory is going to look like. James, John, two that we meet in this story, Peter, Moses, Elijah, and his clothes become whiter than anyone could dye them. His face becomes brighter than the sun in noonday. And this happens all in the middle of the night on top of the mountain. And Peter, who we usually think is just sticking his foot in the mouth, doesn't know what to say, and yet what he says is rather profound. He says, hey, let's build tabernacles, because he knows in Zechariah 14 that at the end time, when the Messiah comes, there's the Feast of Tabernacles, and it's going to be forever feasting in God's presence. Awesome thing. He's putting the pieces together. Then all of a sudden, it's dark again. After the voice, it's all gone. It's just Jesus. Just the plain old Jesus, not the glorified Jesus. Just the ordinary Jesus, not the magnificent Jesus. And so they walk away from Caesarea Philippi just a little bit excited and just a lot of bit confused. So they're walking away from Caesarea Philippi. They come to Galilee, but in chapter 9, verse 30, it says they walk through Galilee. And no more is Jesus stopping to focus on crowds, because at this point now he's stopping to teach his disciples. His focus becomes on these 12. He wants them to understand what it means for him to be this kind of Christ. Chapter 9, verse 33, they come to Capernaum. They leave Capernaum in chapter 10, verse 1. They go to Judea, down south. And they go through Judea and a little across the Jordan River, over into Gentile territory once again. Then in verse 17 of chapter 10, they set out on their journey, but they're stopped. They pause in their journey, and they pause to talk to a rich young ruler. That Jesus issues another discipleship call, and yet he walks away saddened because he had great wealth. Then we come to this verse, verse 32. And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem. They've left Caesarea Philippi. They've gone through Galilee. They've gone to Capernaum. They've gone to Judah. They've gone to the other side of the Jordan. But now we find out where they're going to make this journey to. They're going to Jerusalem. We finally have a destination for this journey. Well, this has to be exciting, because they know that Jerusalem is the capital city. It has been for some time. In fact, it's been the capital city ever since who made it their capital? David did, right? David did. King David. Jerusalem has been their capital since the king made it their capital, made it his capital. It was called Zion, the city of David, the city of Jerusalem. And here we have the Christ, the son of David, the one who's going to be the political leader of the entire world, and he's going to the capital. He's going to Jerusalem. He's going to the place where he can do the greatest good. He's going to the place where he can be king, right? That's what's going on here. He's going to Jerusalem. Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 through 5, speaks of all the excitement, all the anticipation that's bound up in Jerusalem. Sometimes it's called Zion, especially with regard to the fact that it's David's city, David the king. Okay? Listen to Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 through 5. The prophecy is this: it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains. This mount shall be lifted up above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many peoples shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion, out of this capital city of the king, shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he shall judge between the nations and judge and decide disputes for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Let's go to Jerusalem. Let's go to Zion. Let's go to the place where the king will reign. He'll give good decisions, and war will be no more. You ready for that? Well, let's go to that journey. Jesus says, guys, let's go to Jerusalem. wait a minute, this is the Christ. This is the promised Son of David. He's going to the capital. This is awesome. This is going to be great. Their heart is starting to beat just a little bit faster. The disciples know that Jesus is on a journey, but his disciples don't quite realize that Christ is on a mission on this journey. We see as the passage continues to lay out for us at the end of verse 32, and taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was about to happen to him. Guys, this is what's going to happen. And he uses a favorite term of his. He says, understand that the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priest. He doesn't call himself at this point Messiah. He doesn't call himself at this point the Son of God. He doesn't call himself at this point the Christ. He doesn't even call himself the Son of David. He says, understand, the Son of Man is going to go to Jerusalem and he's going to die. His title that he takes for himself is meant to impress upon them the frailty of his life, the humanity, the mortality of his life. Humility, submission. As a man, he must follow in the ways of his God. He must be subject to something higher than himself, his own goals, his own objectives, his own agendas. He says this is what's going to happen. They will condemn him to death, and here's what it's going to look like. They'll mock him, they'll spit on him, they'll flog him, they'll kill him. But don't miss one phrase here that's included in this passage that's not included in the other two predictions. They will condemn him to death, verse 33, and at the very end of the verse, and they will deliver him to whom? The Gentiles. Jesus says, guys, we're going to Jerusalem. And I want you to understand that it is the world stage, but it's not the world stage that you think it is. Not yet. There's an international focus that's going to take place there, but it's not the international focus that you're anticipating. Yes, the Gentiles will be included in this Son of Man experience, but the Son of Man will be under them at this point, not over them at this point. All of this is going right over their heads. They're dazed. It's like when you're talking to your junior high teen and you're giving them instructions and say, and do this, and do this, and do, wait a minute, you gave them more than one thing to do. They're gone. They're done. They can't hear it. Okay? It's like talking to the disciples. Guys, it's like when your wife tells you, and get this roast out at this time, and then do it with this, and then, guys, you just burnt everything, right? Okay? That's what's happening for these disciples. They're getting the instruction. It's going right over their heads. He's the Son of Man. He predicts his death three times now in these three chapters. But the whole point of it is this. As Jesus is going to Jerusalem, he understands that his death is not a peripheral part of his purpose in being on earth. His going to Jerusalem to die is integral to his very identity. It's essential for him to accomplish his mission. It's necessary. Before he can be king of the nations, he must die in place of all people. Jesus knows this. This is his mission. And as he moves toward Jerusalem, Kuravia rightfully calls this a death march. Jesus knows why he's going there. It's interesting, as we look at verse 32, what's Jesus' position in relationship to all the others that are on this way to Jerusalem? Where is Jesus? He's out in front. Don't you think if you were going to a place where you know you're going to die, remember way back when you were a kid and you had to get a spanking, okay? Mom, dad, would call you into the room. How did you go into the room? That wasn't how you did it, right? It's like, do I have to? Nah, you're backing away. Okay. Jesus isn't shrinking. Jesus isn't shirking from what his known destiny is as he goes to the cross. He's leading the charge. In fact, it's interesting to read the rest of that sentence. Jesus is walking ahead of them. They're amazed. They're like, what's wrong with this guy? And they're what? They're afraid. They're afraid. And what Jesus says doesn't necessarily encourage them. Jesus says, verse 33, see, who's going to Jerusalem? We are. Aren't you lucky? I'm going to die in Jerusalem and you're going to go with me. What does that mean for me? If they're killing you and I'm with you, you ever have to see those signs? Chris and Sarah take the teens down. They get out of that locked room. They have signs pointing at each other. I'm with him. I'm with her. Okay? If you're with Jesus, you're telling nobody. Jesus says, we're going to Jerusalem, guys. You're going with me. I'm dying there. Thanks. That would be exciting. What fun. You can bet they're looking at each other. They're wondering. They're afraid. Edward says the use of we in this context has sobering implications. So it's at this point that John and James come up to Jesus. They approach him, and we find in another gospel that their mother is a part of the crowd and comes up to Jesus and makes the request on their behalf. But they come up to Jesus, and they want to secure the answer before they even ask the question. You ever had the kids ask you that? Hey, Dad, can you just say yes? Probably no. Probably not. Why do you phrase the question like that? Is all of a sudden, I'm thinking I might not want to. There might be more cost to this than what I'm banking on. Jesus, can you just say yes? What is it that you guys want? Well, Jesus, can you do for us what we want you to do? Can you grant us to sit one on your left, one on your right when you come in your glory? As they're going up to Jerusalem, the disciples are thinking one thing. Jerusalem, Zion, nations, ruler, peace, prosperity, majesty. That's why we have to look at this next phrase. In your glory. Okay, Jesus says, let's drill down on this one for a little bit. Positively, their request is a request of faith. They really believe that Jesus is the guy, that Jesus is the king, that Jesus is the Messiah. That's good. Okay? They really believe he is, and they really believe he's going to establish a kingdom. So the Christ plus Jerusalem equals the kingdom. It's just simple math. That's how it works. The Christ plus Jerusalem equals the kingdom. That's what they're thinking. But negatively, it shows something other than faith. It shows a selfish ambition on their behalf. Tim Keller helps put this in perspective for us, probably using language that's more relevant today. He says, to them, in your glory means when you're seated on your throne. In this case, the people on the right and the left are like the prime minister and the chief of staff. So John and James are saying, Jesus, when you take power, we'd like to have the top places in your cabinet. Okay, that's what they're wanting. They're believing he's going to do that. He's able to establish this. They're on their way to the ruling of the world. Jesus, can we sit there with you? This request is prompted by a misunderstanding. Jesus has been very clear. He's very consistent in what he's been saying. This is now the third time that he's told them, I'm going to die, and this is what it's going to look like. And this is the most clear he's ever laid it out. This is going to happen. It's going to be the scribes and the priests, the high priests, no less. They're going to turn me over to the Gentiles. The Gentiles are going to take me. They're going to flog me. They're going to spit on me. They're going to kill me. And I will rise after 3 days. But they're still thinking that their way to Jerusalem is the way to victory, the way to grandeur, the way to majesty. So their question is prompted by a misunderstanding, but it's also prompted by self-interest. And here's where things get ugly. They come to Jesus and they call him rabbi, teacher. It's a familiar term. We've seen several use it, knowing that he's the Christ. But they use a lesser term, rabbi. Will you give us what we're asking for here? And it seems as though they're establishing a link of loyalty. Teacher, we're just your students. We're just your humble students. And we just want to acknowledge our humility before you and ask that you would give us great glory with you. It's kind of one of those things that maybe we slide it in under the radar. He'll miss the fact that it's really about me and not about him. Here's where worship and devotion all of a sudden gets mingled with self-interest, and something happens that's rather ugly. In fact, it's so ugly that the other 10, how do they respond? It uses the word, they're indignant. How dare they ask that? Why are the other 10 so upset? Because they didn't ask him first. How dare they ask? I wanted that position. Jesus forces them to put into words, so fellas, what is it? What is it that you actually want? What can I do for you? It's going to be the same question that he asks of Bartimaeus in just a few more verses. But Jesus forces them to articulate, what is it that you actually want? Dan gave us a little bit of a commercial for a prayer time here on Sunday mornings. I'd encourage you, if you can come out, be a part of that. It's an important thing. What we're trying to do during that prayer time is we're trying to pray not through every request possible, but we're trying to pray through our lives in the way that Jesus told us to pray. But oftentimes when we pray, don't we sound a little bit like John and James? Don't we sound like, Jesus, will you do whatever we ask you to? Oh, and by the way, here's my list. It's like as we're getting ready for Christmas, right? Write out your list. What are the things you'd like for Christmas? Oh, wait a minute. Do you have another piece of paper? I mean, another ream of paper, I'm sorry. Just a minute. Let me jot it down for you. And as they bring their request to Jesus, they incriminate themselves. Jesus, here's what we want you to do. We want you to make our lives comfortable because life is really all about us, as we put it, under you. And their worship becomes a means of serving themselves. Now, before we laugh too hard or point fingers too pointedly at these men, just listen to what that's saying. God, make my life comfortable because life is all about me as I put my life under you. Is there a tendency for us to use God for our benefit, for our glory, for our comfort, for our advancement? If we're not careful, we can use God rather than giving ourselves to God to be what? To be used, right? To be used by him. Who's God in the situation? God's God. But don't we? Can't we? Do we treat God the way a pagan would treat their idol? They'd set that little idol up on the shelf, made out of whatever. And they'd come to the idol, they'd put food in front of it, they'd rub it, they'd do whatever, they'd offer incense to it, and they'd come to that idol and say, okay, idol, I've given you some good stuff, so now can you give me all the good stuff that I want? Because I want to manipulate you so that you give me all that I want. Because in my little world, I'm the center. I'm the most important. I'll acknowledge you. I'll give you stuff that is really useless to you, so long as you give me everything that I need or think that I need, that I want. Idolatry is having a God other than God, and it's not an idol, it's me. It's manipulating something so that I get to be at the center of my life. That's what John and James are doing at this point. And the interesting thing is, they're on the inside. When you think of the good guys, they're the best of the good guys. Okay? So before we start making fun of them and pointing fingers at them, understand that their problem is our problem. They look like me. Jesus says, you have no idea what the way of the king even looks like. Yes, I'm going up to Jerusalem to die. Yes, I'm going up to Jerusalem for everybody else's sake. Yes, I will come and display glory. Let's redefine what glory is. Jesus answers them not in terms of divine blessings, but in terms of divine judgment. He says, You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I can drink? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism with which I'm about to be baptized? In the Old Testament, the cup usually symbolizes something that's allotted by God. It can signify joy. There's some instances of that in the Psalms. But more frequently, especially in Isaiah, it has to do with the cup of God's wrath, the cup of God's judgment. That which is poured out by God and administered to man. The term baptism also has equally violent overtones. It's connected with sorrow and grief, Edwards writes. He says it has about the sense of being forcibly plunged beneath the waters, to be cast into the depths. It's to take that four-year-old and drop them in the deep end of the pool. Can you swim? Oh, yeah, not a problem. We got this one, Jesus. You don't know what you're asking when you are in your glory. Jesus says, let's talk about glory for a second. Go back to Exodus chapter 33. We've been here. We're not doing another study through the book of Exodus, but we can't forget where we've been in the story. Exodus 33. They've sinned. They've done the idolatry thing. They've built the golden calf right after the Ten Commandments are given. Exodus chapter 33. Moses is talking to God. Moses is pleading with God. God, don't leave us. Don't forsake us. Please. God says, Moses, I'm not going to leave you. I know you. And then Moses, in verse 18, makes a request, an astonishing request. He's been in God's presence on top of the mount. He's seen the glory of God, and he has this one request, verse 18. Please show me your glory. God's talking to Moses, man to man, face to face, God to man. And he says in verse 19, Moses, you've asked to see my glory. What am I going to make pass before you? What does he say there in verse 19? I will make my goodness pass before you. What else will he give him? I will proclaim my name. Chapter 34, verse 6. Verse 5. The Lord descended in the cloud, and he stood with Moses up there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, I am who I am, Yahweh, Yahweh, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity, transgressions, and sins. This is the glory that Moses asks to see. God, will you show me your glory? God says, Moses, I'll do better than that. I will show you wherein my glory resides. My glory resides in my goodness. This is what it means for me to be a God who's different from all other gods. You've sinned against me, and I'm not walking away from you. I'm abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Go to John chapter 1 now, verse 14. John chapter 1. God says, what is my glory? My glory is my goodness. It's bound up in my name. A God who's steadfast in his love, his faithfulness, his truth. John chapter 1, verse 14. And the Word became flesh, that's Jesus, we know that. And he dwelt, he tabernacled among us. Wow, this is Exodus language. We have seen his glory. glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Greek terms, referencing the Hebrew terms, steadfast love and faithfulness. We've beheld the glory of God in whom? John chapter 1, verse 14. We beheld the glory of God in Jesus. We've beheld the glory of God in Jesus. Okay, what does glory look like? God says, here's what my glory looks like. And he's not going to flex his muscles. He's not going to shine brighter. God says, you want to know what sets me apart from all other gods? You want to know what makes me unique, lovable, worthy of praise, is the fact that I don't turn away from you when you turn away from me. I am the God who's committed to you in steadfast love. It's my goodness that is my glory. John, James, Jesus, hey, can we have like glory with you when you come in glory? Jesus says, you don't understand what my glory is. My glory is showcasing the character of my Father. You know what it looks like? Glory looks like this. It looks like a cross. Yes, there's going to be one on my left, one on my right, when I showcase the glory of my Father. But who's going to be on my left and who's going to be on my right? Two malefactors. Jesus says, when the glory of my God is displayed, you really want to be there? You have no idea what you're asking. No idea what you're asking. This is what my glory looks like. I'm showcasing the glory of my God, who showcases his goodness in me, in my weakness, in my death. Moving rapidly along, we have to talk about now the clarified vision. Well, we can't move too quickly. We've got to come to verse 45. Jesus redefines for them what lordship is. He takes them aside. He gathers them together. He says, guys, understand, those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles, verse 42, lord it over them. Their great ones exercise authority. It's not this way with you. He doesn't say it will not be this way with you. He doesn't say it cannot be this way with you. He says, this is not the way it works for anybody following me. If you think of it in terms other than these, you're not my disciple. You're not on the inside. You're still on the outside. You're thinking in the wrong way. This term Lord is only ever referred to Jesus in the book of Mark, or to God. And so using it with these terminology, it puts it in stark contrast to the power-pursuing disciples. Jesus says, it can't be this way among you. Whoever would be great must be your servant. Whoever would be first must be slave. Now, he's putting this in terminology that's just as stark as it's impossible for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. It's impossible for you to be first unless you are last. You can't. It doesn't work. It doesn't happen. And then he says, verse 45, and he starts out with a big word, because. There's a lot of weight in that word, because. It can't be this way with you because this is the way it is with me. It is this way. This is what I'm doing. This is who I am. Even the Son of Man came not passively to gain glory for himself, to be served by others, but me. The Son of Man, frail, humble, submissive, showcased the glory of God by living and dying for others, to give his life a ransom. For many is the idea of in the place of, as a substitute. The one who doesn't just take off his coat and lay it down over the mud puddle, it's the guy who gets down face down and puts himself in the mud puddle so that one can walk across his back. Jesus says, that's what I'm doing for you, and you don't even know it. Don't keep me from it. Guys, your destiny is bound up in who I am and what I'm doing. And you've got to follow me in this journey. You're a part of this. Let's move to the next scenario, the clarified vision of reckless abandon. We like Bartimaeus in this story, especially as he's slapped up against James and John, who are in it for themselves. Verse 46, and they came to Jericho. Okay, so we get there. Next sentence. And he's leaving Jericho. Pretty short trip. Like, Chris, how did your trip to China go? Oh, good. What'd you do? Went to China. How'd it go? Good. I just told you that. Good, thanks. That's what I wanted to know. They went to Jericho. They're leaving Jericho. Jericho is a place that's really, it's important. It's important in the time and day of Jesus because the Herodians had made it a site of their winter palace. It was the city of roses. It was literally called that. It was a beautiful place. And yet in the middle of this majesty on an earthly plane, there's an outsider. His name is Bartimaeus. The word Bartimaeus means son of Timaeus. It means son of impurity. Here's this, if you think of it this way, here's this filth. In the city of roses, every city has its filth. Enter Bartimaeus. Here's the filth on the side of the road. We'd rather not have to see this, Jesus. Sorry to bring you through this, but you got to do with what you got to do. There's Bartimaeus, the filth, sitting on the side of the road, and he cries out, Jesus, what? Son of David, have mercy on me. Here's the beautiful thing about Bartimaeus. Bartimaeus knows one thing. He has a desperate need. He's a blind man. He has a coat. It may be all that he has. We don't know where he goes at night to get out of the elements, but we know that during the day, he's sitting on the side of the road. He's wrapped up in his coat. It's what he needs to protect him from the sun. It's what he needs to protect him from the rain. What he gets from others. That's all that he gets. He can't do anything. He can't get anything of his own working, of his own ability. He had nothing and needs everything. And we see, it's interesting how he writes this. They came to Jerusalem. They're leaving Jerusalem. If Bartimaeus doesn't act now, he's never going to have another opportunity because Jesus is on his way to end his life in Jerusalem. He comes into Jericho. He's leaving Jericho. Bartimaeus says, I've got to do this now. I've got one chance, one shot at Jesus. I have a need. And so he calls out, Jesus, have mercy on me. And the beautiful thing is that Jesus stops. You see how this story is told? Verse 48. Many rebuke him and tell him to be silent. And so what does he do? He cries out all the more. You ever had somebody in your family embarrass you out in public because they raised their voice and got people's attention? Cress is not here today. She's sick. She'll be okay if I tell her this story. Don't tell her I told it. No, I'm kidding. She was 3 years old. We were at Calvary. And we're sitting in the very back of the auditorium. And Ron Hamilton came. He's dressed up as Patch the Pirate. We'd listen to Patch the Pirate. She knew Patch the Pirate was going to be there. We're sitting there. It's a Sunday night. And sure enough, Patch the Pirate comes out. Everything's nice and quiet. He's just getting ready to introduce himself. And all of a sudden from the back, hi, Patch the Pirate! Standing up on the pew. Her mother and her father are ducking under the pew. Okay. Here's Bartimaeus. Jesus! Son of David, have mercy on me. Shut up. Quiet. I won't be quiet. I want to know Jesus hears me. So he shouts out louder. And what happens? It says, verse 49, and Jesus did what? Jesus stopped. You think it's a miracle back. You're talking with Joshua. He's fighting a battle. He's losing time. The sun is beginning to go down, and he prays, and God causes the sun to stand still. Folks, as Jesus, the Son of God, is walking through Jericho, because of a blind man's cry, the sun stands still. And he pays attention to one man who has a need and who won't let that need go unnoticed in the presence of the only one who can rescue him. He has not only a vision of his desperate need, but he has a vision of Christ's great sufficiency. He calls him Jesus, Son of David. This is the messianic title. No other one in all the book of Mark calls him by this name, no other human. And as he voices this regal term, as this king is passing through Jericho in route to his capital city to ride in triumphal entry on the kingly donkey, as Solomon did so many years before, Son of David, through the very same part of the city, he stops him and he recognizes, you are the one that we've been looking for. You're the one our hearts desire. And he comes up to him and he says, Rabbi, actually he says, Rabboni. You've heard that phrase before. You usually hear that term at Easter. It's the only other time it's used. As Mary Magdalene is in the garden, she doesn't know who the gardener is. And so she says, just tell me where they've taken him. And he speaks one word. He says, Mary. She turns to him and says, Rabboni, Master. Not just rabbi, teacher, but my master, my teacher. It's a term of, you're mine. And he acknowledges Jesus. He says, Jesus, now that I got you, I'm not going to let you go. My master, here's what I need from you. And he states his need. Not only is there a vision of desperate need and a vision of his great sufficiency, we see also that there's a vision that awakens a passionate pursuit. They said, okay, loudmouth, get up. He's calling you. Hurry up. He gets up. He takes off his coat, and what's he do with his coat? Throws it away. I don't need this anymore. There's something bigger happening now. Maybe the one possession that he has, he takes it, and he throws it, and he runs to Jesus. Can you imagine what that would look like, a blind man running? What would that look like? It looked pretty silly, wouldn't it? Did he care how he looked? No. Because Jesus is waiting for him. Jesus is calling him. He says, Son, what would you have me to do? He says, Jesus, I have one need. I just need you to open my eyes. Jesus tells him, Son, go your way. Your faith has saved you. What an amazing tenderness as he leans on Jesus, calling him his own master, teacher, rabbi, submits to the way of this king. And Jesus says to him, go your way. And immediately he recovered his sight. And how does verse 52 end? Immediately he recovered his sight and did what? He followed him on the way. The way to where? The way to Jerusalem. The way to the cross. Jesus says, get up, son. You've got your eyesight. You can go any way you want to go. Go your way. Bartimaeus says, really? There's only one way I can go. You know that. Where would I go? Where am I going to go? I'm going with you. Wherever you go, I go. And so, whatever follows here from chapter 11 on, who gets to see it with eyes brand new opened? Bartimaeus. He sees the triumphal entry. He sees the crucifixion. He's there in town, listening, hearing, witnessing the fact that Jesus is not only dead, but Jesus is now alive. We began this sermon the story of Helen Keller, a blind girl whose story includes heroic bravery, incredible achievements. But Helen Keller only had a very cloudy understanding of the Bible and the God of the Bible. I'd like to close our time with another woman who was blind, became blind as just a little girl, 6 weeks, got a fever, put mustard poultice all over her eyes. She may or may not have been blinded by that, nobody knows. Her name's Fanny Crosby. And at a young age, Fanny Crosby's eyes were opened to the glories of Jesus Christ. She started writing poetry at an early age, about 8 years old. And by the time her life is done, she penned some 9,000 hymns, rejoicing in the God who is her Savior. At the end of her life, she said this, It seemed intended by the blessed providence of God that I should be blind all my life, and I thank Him for that dispensation. If perfect earthly sight were offered to me tomorrow, I would not accept it. I might not have sung hymns to the praise of God if I'd been distracted by the beautiful and interesting things all about me. My friend, you have one of two visions. A vision that is either clouded by a relentless self-interest, putting you at the center of your life. You get all wrapped up, you get all worked up because life isn't working out for you. Or you have a clarified vision. Because what happens to you really doesn't matter, because it's all about Him. What's your perspective this morning? Because in the way of the King, we see that the path to life is defined not by comfort, not by riches, not by splendor, not by respect, not by glory, by death. The path to life is death. Why? Because even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give His life in the place of others who walk across His back to inherit eternal life.